We are going to move on with Acts chapter 2. We had talked about Peter and his address to the crowd there in Jerusalem. Now the setting again is that the Holy Spirit is doing something on the earth. This is the crucial issue, and not so much all the details of exactly how he does it. To try and ferret out all the theological issues, it only brings us to grief. It has been so through the centuries of church history. It's never done anything but bring grief. The simplicities with which the people of God just come together and fellowship and study the Word and so forth will keep stability there. The push to find out all the details theologically and put every piece in place will split the body. We have our fellowship there with a great variety of people. And in the years that we've been teaching, whereas there have been a lot of people that have not appreciated the ministry, for which I am not surprised, but people that are really simply want to follow Christ and enjoy some fellowship together do stay steady, and we don't have any division. We don't have any people lining up on a couple of different sides of the fence. We have ones that leave. I don't know if I understand that, but we come there not to debate, but to fellowship in the Word. I do not erect a system of theology for a number of reasons. One of the main reasons is that I don't think we human beings can erect a system of theology. Someone came to me the other day and said, well, I've got to separate, I've become a Reformed theologian in the Reformed Church. Now, simply stated, the Reformed theologian is a departure from the Calvinist position, which is pretty hard rock. John Calvin was a part of that Reformation period of history. Now, in the era when Luther and Calvin and others came together, the Roman Church had dominated the religious scene there in Europe. And there were numbers of things that had evolved out of that Roman Church, and it was all moving in the direction of a totally lifeless, sterile, ritualistic religion, far removed from the simplicities of the life of Christ. The Roman Church was not the only church there. That is, they were not the only representative of the body of Christ, because during that time, 15th, 16th, 17th centuries, there were numbers of small groups of people meeting, like the brethren types, Menno Simons, and of course he was a little later than the Reformation, but earlier, the Brethren of the Common Life, and small groups of people that were simple followers of Christ. In the midst of that, you had this giant dragon of the Roman Church. The people that were automatically members of that church, as surely as they were part of a given community. There was no other. In the average, let's say the feudal estate, the feudal barony, where you had a village with a lot of the craftsmen and so forth, and either inside or usually often inside the walls of the castle or right outside the walls, all of this was dominated by Rome. The Roman Church would excommunicate these poor souls to drop the hat, and they kept them in line by that device because they figured that if they were excommunicated from the church, they could not be saved. They were just lost souls. They couldn't get married or buried or anything else. Well, by that device, they held these people in an iron grip. I saw a demonstration of that yesterday at the funeral service for my niece. Her husband was Catholic, and so he had a Catholic service. But I was so impressed. I was almost furious when I got out. In fact, I was really, I had a lot to do to keep from walking out of the middle of it, you know, but it was so sterile and barren, and the priest, you know, gave the rituals, which were just almost inaudible. The people don't really pay any attention to what he says. To them, there are a lot of good souls in Catholic Church, I'm sure of that. Of course, this is what made me furious, these people coming there desperately needing some comfort and help. Of course, it had this great barn-like structure, which most of these churches are, the cathedrals, and it just chilled to the bone. And sitting there, and the loudspeaker was on so loud that you couldn't even, it was like being bombarded by this mechanical device all the time. The whole thing looked like a form of the Catholic Inquisition. And I thought to myself that I just sat there and I thought, now, the Catholic Church is a disgrace to God, a denial of the grace of Christ, and an insult to the mind and body and spirit of God's creatures. You know, it was a really wretched experience. It never changed since the Middle Ages, and they're never going to change. You know, the people that are talking about getting together with them, like the Lutherans and so forth, they're just walking into the trap. They're not going to change. And I thought to myself, they couldn't care less what those poor people were suffering out there. It wouldn't matter to the priest. He was warm and robed and everything else up there. And I thought that's the way it is in Latin America. They build these great cathedrals and the poor souls crawl in rags to burn a candle in it, you know. And the leaders don't care about the people. And yet these are God's sheep, you know. And he said, if anybody offends one of these little ones of mine, they're better than a millstone or cast about his neck and were drowned in the sea. So the church has abused the people of God for centuries, and the days are coming when they're going to be judged for that. And I don't accept the mask of friendship that they put on in America. Of course, they're outnumbered in America. They have to be conciliatory here and modify their attitudes and so forth. But in Latin America, where they have the dominance, they don't modify anything. And those poor souls are kept in superstition and darkness down there. They never try to enlighten the Mexican peasant, the villager, about his ancient tribal religious beliefs. They just take them along with the Catholic Church. And they blend pagan ritual in Latin America with the Roman Church, and it fits pretty nicely together. They're both the same piece of cloth. And the leadership move in splendor and untouched for the people. Now, I have to say to you, I'm certain there are here and there priests, individual priests, that have different attitudes, but by and large, the church puts on a mask in America especially, and they try to be conciliatory. Now, for example, this young couple that I told you about, the family was, of course, very unhappy that she was going to marry a non-Catholic boy. In fact, I think he wound up finally wouldn't even sign the statement that the children have to be brought up in a church, you know. But it was a big battle going on all the time. Now, the attitude of the girl's father was sort of like this. Well, all I care is that we don't break up our nice family unity. That's what disturbed him more than anything else. She was breaking from the family. Well, she was being honest about her faith. But her father and I had some conversations together, and he's a pretty naive fellow, nice guy, but naive. And he appreciated my ministry a lot. And we had good fellowship, you know, and he really admired a great deal for my message, not me personally. He was feeling, well, the girl's in good hands, you know, so she and her husband come to our meetings and everything, and he felt, well, if she doesn't go to Mass, as long as she goes to your service, of course, the Catholic believes that not going to Mass is a mortal sin, not to go to Mass. People like her father didn't really believe that. So the girl's uncle came over from New Guinea. This guy's the vicar general. He's down there. So he's pretty well into the church. So he and I spent about 6 hours together one day, I took him through the Bible, through Hebrews and the other places, and I expected he would be ignorant of the Scriptures, which he was. And of course, he said things to me that were not really true about what they believe. You know, and he sort of led me to believe that we were in fellowship, and that, you know, it was nice that the girl would come to our services as long as he, you know, this. I knew he was not giving me the truth. Well, then they got the girl, and the family got this girl before the wedding. And they started talking to her, and they had her uncle there, and he was telling her that it was a mortal sin for her not to go to the Mass. If she went to my services, she was going to be cut off, and just all. And then even her father got upset with her, with his brother, the guy that was talking to her. But, you know, it all came out there. All the stuff he laid on me was baloney. And those people believe what they say. So, you know, like these Lutherans are trying to get together with the Catholics now. All right, now, all of this I'm saying in this direction, that the Catholic Church got a stranglehold of the Roman Church. You have to understand where the Church came from, what was the dominant religious force in Europe during the Middle Ages and immediately following the last gasp of the early apostolic church. Now understand that the book of Acts then is a history of the church, but of course it cuts off when Paul cuts off the end. And the last word that we have from an apostle is from John in Revelation. That's about 100 A.D., you know, plus or minus a few years. Now, what happened after that? That's the question. Immediately, or very shortly after this period that the Acts talks about, there emerged in the church five patriarchates, they were called. Five sectors to the church as it spread out around the world. So one of these was Jerusalem. The second one was Constantinople. The third one was Antioch. The fourth one was Hippo down in Africa. And the fifth one was Rome. Here are these five almost equal sectors of the church, overseen by what they call a patriarch. As the church went on, guidance, of course, was needed, and issues had to be decided and resolved, issues that did not have backing in the scripture as such. I mean, you know, what are we going to do with our government relationships and so forth? Now, Rome being the more or less world metropolis beyond all others would be looked to voluntarily for strong leadership. Just like if you had the Bishop of Los Angeles would probably be a lot more powerful figure than the Bishop of Oxnard. See? That's the way it was. Antioch was a fairly small place, Hippo and all these places. But the Bishop of Rome emerged, especially since the seat of government was there, emerged as sort of the strong figure. And everybody voluntarily looked to him for guidance. And so he would become the most influential of the patriarchs. Two things, major things happen in history. The church, Rome faltered and was split by Constantine in about 315 A.D. He was then the emperor of Rome. Well, he took the major seat of Roman authority to Constantinople, which had been before that time was old Byzantium, the center of the Byzantine culture. When he took the church to, or took the government to Constantinople, he also split the church down the middle, and where he went, there was the emergence of what we call the Eastern Orthodox Church, what the Russian today and the Greek, Russians, Greeks, the Slavic people are all members of the Greek Orthodox, Eastern Orthodox Church. So you've got the Russian Orthodox, prior to communists at least. These were an eastern part of the religion. All right, now, when the center of Roman power moved to Constantinople, what was left in Rome was a much weakened version of government. But it retained, now more than ever, its power over the Western religious, Western church. Whereas the center of secular power was in Constantinople, religious power still remained in Rome. Okay, now the collapse of the Roman Empire was about 475. And of course, part of that was due to the attacks of the barbaric hordes from the east, Attila the Hun and the Ostrogoths and the Visigoths and some of these people, the Vandals and so forth. So finally, it staggered and fell to its knees and all but collapsed. And now, from 475 until 800 A.D., there was no significant government in the Western world. From the tip of Italy on up to the Baltic Sea and up into the Nordic countries was all a might makes right or survival of the fittest thing. So that's when this feudal system emerged. And a guy has a plot of land, and so he gets some men to give their allegiance to him. He becomes what they call the liege lord or the king. They call them kings, but they were pretty small domains of these people. King Arthur was not really quite what, the king of England was, you know, later. But these were little fiefdoms, they call them, and baronial estates. So anyway, like I said, the castle is built as a fortress. A number of men who were called knights were given special consideration for defending the castle. So they were given their little piece of land for doing that. That was called the Dark Ages, actually, from 475 to 800. 800 is the time that the Carolingian dynasty emerged, with Charlemagne. The name Charlemagne, C-H-R-A-R-L-E-M-A-G-N-E, Charlemagne, I could call him Charlie Magny, but Charlemagne means simply Charles the Great. Magna is great, Charles is Charles. And the name Charles and the name Carl are the same, or Carol, C-A-R-O-L. So the Carolingian dynasty, which is what that was called, emerged about 800 A.D. with Charlemagne taking a dominant place and welding together an empire with the Catholic Church backing him. At that time, the Roman Church was the only organized leadership in the whole complex of people. And you have what was known as the Holy Roman Empire, which went from Italy up to the Baltic Sea, but it was not an empire as such. It was just the sphere of influence of the Roman Church. But it was neither an empire, nor was it Roman, and certainly wasn't holy. But there it was, this whole sector. So this is what is going on after the fall of Rome. Now, all of the Christian population, generally speaking, came under this dominance, except for small groups of people, which incidentally represent stepping stones from the early apostles to the present day. And you can trace that clear back to that time that God never was without a true witness. And that is the tradition which I would identify with what we're doing. Just the simple people trying to keep the primacy of Christ in the midst of the burgeoning hierarchies of religion. See? And you have them now coming in the... not just the what we normally regard as the old line denominations like the Presbyterians and so forth. Although incidentally, the Presbyterians were known as dissenters. They were the little people like us back in the days when England held to the state religion. The Anglican religion was the state religion of England, and the Presbyterians were people that were breaking away from that tradition, which was very much Catholic. See, the Anglican Church differed from the Roman Church mainly in the fact that Henry VIII declared it different. In other words, that was what we call the Act of Supremacy in about 1580. Henry VIII separated from the Roman Church and evolved the Anglican Church. Of course, some people say it's because he wanted to have license to continue his marital interactions and affairs. Extramarital and otherwise, and so he split from the church, so they wouldn't grant him the right to divorce his wife, so he wanted his own church, so he became the head of the Church of England. I think the Queen still carries that title today, head of the church or whatever. Now at that time, the Presbyterian people like the Presbyterians and the Methodists and some of these others were dissenters who broke away from that, and some of them suffered much persecution for that very fact. But always there have been these stepping stones or these patches of light down through the history of the church. Well, now, during that dark, going back to Dark Ages period, though, there was also an era of, since the collapse of the Roman Empire, there was an era of intellectual darkness as well. The main business of the day was killing and plowing, you know, you can keep some food coming along and kill off your marauding neighbors and so forth. That was about all anybody had time to do. It was a very bleak period of time. Now, the Renaissance, that called means a rebirth. N-A-I-S-A-N-C-E is birth, and the R-E means a rebirth. The Renaissance, which came in the 12th century, in the 1100s, was the sudden bursting forth of an enlightened intellectual era, cultural era. Art was so negligible in those early Dark Ages, and art began to flourish again, and writing, and universities began to emerge with the Aristotelian method of education. They followed the pattern of Aristotle. Aristotelian philosophy pretty well dominated university efforts. People like Copernicus and Galileo were the vanguard of scientific rebirth, but they were persecuted deeply by the church, greatly. The church did not want that kind of enlightenment. As far as they were concerned, the earth was the center of the universe, and everybody else be damned. You know, and so the people like Copernicus and Galileo were persecuted, and yet, of course, it was their enlightenment that rescued science from becoming just a superstitious morass. In fact, I have to say this to you, as long as we're in that general area, that people like Voltaire, for example, have long been identified as atheists. Were really not atheists. They just felt the church ought to keep its nose out of science. That's all. And he was very upset with the church mixing and trying to, and he felt that the church was smothering enlightenment, which they were, of course, by their superstitious attitude. Well, all through this era, then, of the Dark Ages we were talking about, there was a gradual rise of the church as a political unit. It was Pharisaism all over again, because they were political more than they were religious, really. So in those days, owning property was a very important thing. Very few people had property. There came a point where no one could even buy property. I mean, a commoner could never own property, could not buy it. A Jew could never own property. Now, some of these fellows were wealthy merchants. Some of the merchants were more wealthy than the property owners. But anyway, the church was interested in accumulating property and money, of course. So a guy could, either for property or money, could buy his way into the bishopric. Well, let me put it this way. A merchant could buy his way into the bishopric, and because he was a member of a class called the clergy, he could then own property. There were three estates in those days, the nobility, the clergy, and the commoner. Now, the commoner were not necessarily the poor people, but they were the unpropertied people. The clergy and the nobility were the aristocracy. That's when the French Revolution came along. That was the great knuckle that was part of the essence of the revolution. Because, you see, whenever the estates got together, the clergy and the nobility voted together, and the commoner, estate had one vote. And so the clergy and nobility always voted together, and the commoner was left out in the cold. That was one of the things that sparked the French Revolution, as a matter of fact. But the church became identified with monarchy, with superstition, with tyranny. They just dominated the scene of Europe during those days. In those days, I think the word church would have been as much a question as it is today. You get to the place in the church today where you can hardly use the word anymore. Okay, so the church was dominating the scene. People were oppressed as much by the church or more than by any government institution. In the 1600s, 17th century, you had the Spanish Inquisition, where Catholic Church was torturing people to really deep lengths to ferret out all non-Christians, Jews, and so forth by torture. Read the history of the Inquisition. a bloody, rotten era where the church was just torturing children and everything. I mean, they'd, in order to get the parents to recant, they'd take their children and torture them. And they have a bloody history, I'll tell you that. Incidentally, the name Catholic is a name they stole from us. The Greek word Catholic, katholike, means universal. If you've ever followed a creed in your church service, it says we believe in the Holy Catholic Church. That doesn't mean the Roman Catholic. That means in the Holy Universal Church. But the Catholics stole the term from us. So now they believe they are the only true church. And they still believe it. Don't be fooled by the peaceful discussions that they have with the Protestants. They still believe that. And if they can sucker the Protestant churches into joining with them in an ecumenical movement, they still believe they're the supreme one, and that the other people are coming back to the fold. Okay. All right, now we can be grateful to Martin Luther, who in the 16th century shattered that tradition and broke through with the Protestant Reformation. October 31st, on All Saints, on a Halloween night, 1517, Luther tacked onto the door of the church at Wittenberg, the Roman church, 95 statements of contest or conflict with the church. And he was precipitated to do this by something that was taking place at that time called the sale of indulgences. That was another one of the problems of the Roman church. In addition to simony, which was the buying of bishoprics, you know, so some godless landowner becomes a bishop. In addition to that was the sale of indulgences, in that you could buy your way out of purgatory. Of course, they still believe that, no? Basically. You could buy your way out of purgatory by giving money to the church. Of course, I thought of that yesterday in that funeral. This guy is giving all these glowing statements about comfort and everything else, and I thought, young lady, he's saying these glowing things about her going into the arms of Christ. And I said to myself, you know, what are you talking about? You believe she's going into purgatory. Why are you talking like that? That's what they believe. You don't go immediately to heaven. You have to spend a little time in purgatory first. And how much time you spend depends upon how much you have to give.
Yeah. My aunt's still paying for my uncle.
That's right.
Paying every month she buys a mass for him.
Well, the people, the biggies like the Kennedys and some of those people, they had to really pay through the nose. Especially since Mr. Kennedy, ex-President Kennedy's past was not altogether cherubic. they really stuck him for that. But you see, now they wanted to build St. Peter's Basilica in Rome. So they needed money, a lot of money. So they were selling indulgences, and they had a special dispensation from the Pope. Then the dispensation given by the Pope was that anybody who contributed any amount of money to the Basilica could immediately free whoever they wanted from purgatory. Every gift they gave would free someone from purgatory. The German, it was in Germany that Luther was active, and guy that came through there, a fellow by the name of Petzl, like a local traveling salesman coming through there selling indulgences. Luther hated his guts. Petzl had a saying, the moment the translator freely into English goes, the moment the money into the treasury clinks, the soul from purgatory springs. so he's going around a little bell selling these indulgences there. Well, that was the last straw as far as Luther was concerned. So he had been studying this. Now, Luther was an interesting figure because he had been a rounder, a real rabble, well, not a rabble rouser, but roué, you know, a rounder. I don't know what you call him today, but he used to live in the beer halls of Germany, you know, and he was a law student. And he drank himself under the table every night, frankly, but he was coming home from one of his brawls one night, or his beer bus, and he almost got hit by lightning, barely escaped his life, so it just shook him to the roots, and he suddenly decided he was on the wrong track. He better get himself into the kingdom. So he went to a monastery. The abbey of the monastery was von Staupitz, I think, if I remember correctly. The Lord must have directed him into that monastery. Von Staupitz had an approach to the church that probably was a little more, he had a little more savvy than the others, who were just buried in superstition. The first shot was getting him into the abbey there, and then the second was that this von Staupitz at one point turned him around in the monastery from the typical Catholic or attitude of a priest to the monks. See, the monks, of course, the church believes that you have to punish the body to free the spirit. So a lot of these guys are novitiates, and the guys who are studying for the priesthood, they'll wear rocks in their shoes and wear them around all day. Some of them put a little glass in their belt or something so that keeps rubbing. And they just live in a very penurious, wretched estate to prove their worth. One of the fellows I know very well, a guy by the name of Barry, had been a priest, and he'd gone up the line. He'd started as a novitiate, you know, he started out and he went through all of his agony as a novitiate. And then he finally broke into the priesthood, you know, he finally was confirmed or was ordained. And he was living in penury and begging and all that kind of stuff. The first place they sent him was to Chicago. And when he hit the parish house there in Chicago, all of a sudden the whole thing was exposed to him as a great con, because now he comes there and here are these priests living in the lap of luxury. The liquor cabinet had the finest of liquors in it, and plush surroundings, and they had servants and everything else. And so he comes out of this. He's now, you know, waiting till he finally hits the big time, and now he's going to really be with the angelic priests. And all of a sudden, he finds it's all a hoax. These guys are just living in luxury. I was in a parish house and all these places. I was, and this priest I was working with, I was up in his apartment there, and he got a liquor up on his shelf. You know, the finest Chivas Regal and all the good stuff is there. And, you know, they live very well indeed. And this sort of blew his mind, and he saw the hoax, and he stayed with it for a while, but then he got out of the priesthood, and I had quite a lot of conversations with him. The point, of course, is that the whole church was a farce in those days, and Luther happened to come across a guy that was pretty straight. Now, so anyway, Luther was really trying very hard to go through all of these torments and everything, and so he would lie on a cold stone floor at night, no bed or anything. He'd lie on the floor all night and trying to prove his worth or do penance, I guess, for his life of crime and so forth. But anyway, so this von Staupitz got him thinking one day when he saw Luther. And Luther was just far and away the most assiduous at punishing himself. So von Staupitz said, "Look, Luther, you're never going to save your soul by punishing your body." And that just sort of, hit Luther like that. And he began to study the Bible, which is a very good thing. Not too commonly done in the Roman Church. And so he began studying, and the whole subject of justification by faith evolved out of his studies. That is the idea that we're not saved by these works, but we're saved by our faith. And there was a gradual enlightenment of this. One time he was sent to Rome, a special mission. He was still within the church. A special mission, and he was climbing the Sancta Scala, the holy staircase, on his knees. He got about halfway up, and this whole thing just suddenly hit him, you know, about what am I doing here? And he jumped up and left the place and went back and started writing these tracts against the church, and suddenly the whole thing began to open up to him. And so he had accumulated all these ideas against the church, and so on Halloween night, and he went and nailed these theses on the door of Wittenberg, and of course then the church took after him immediately, and he was spirited away by a friend of his into a tower somewhere at one of these points here, and he was brought before what they call the Diet of Worms, The Diet is a council, and Worms was the place where it was held in Germany. But it comes out the Diet of Worms, which doesn't sound too appetizing to the average person. It helps to remember the matter. Anyway, at this Diet of Worms, he was asked to recant, take back all that he said. And he, of course, he made his famous statement, here I stand, I cannot do otherwise. And so then that was when afterward the church hired, just like the Pharisees, had hired their gang of cutthroats to ambush Luther and kill him. But a friend of his got wind of the thing and got him away and got him up into this tower for safekeeping until he could get things put together. John Calvin, then, in Switzerland, joined in the same Reformation. Of course, all hell broke loose after this whole thing. And they had 30 years of war, actual physical warfare, over the Reformation issues. And Calvin over in Switzerland had the same ideas. I mean, they had a similar approach as Luther, and so he joined in with it. But now the point is this. Here, Calvin and Luther and Zwingli gave the church a tremendous boost. I mean, they delivered it from the doldrums of the Roman hierarchy, in effect. But then they went on, especially Calvin, to form a theological system which became, once again, a rope around the neck of the church. That's the problem, Zita. At the points where reformations have taken place, the very Reformation itself, or the very revival, carries with it the seeds of its own destruction. So it happened with Luther, the Lutheran Church. His protege was Philip Melanchthon, actually the German name is Schwarzer, but Melanchthon is the same in Greek. Melanchthon in Greek means black earth. And so Schwarzer in German means black earth. But he took the name of Melanchthon. And he was the one that wrote the Augsburg Confession, which was the Lutheran theology. And of course, Calvin wrote the Calvin theology, which was the theology of the, has been the theology of the Presbyterian Church and some others for many centuries. But the point was that these fellows started out like this, and then they gradually fell into the trap of trying to make a system out of their theology. All the pieces in their mind have to fit together, but the problem with that is that the human brain isn't really able to fit all of God's knowledge together. We put it and try to fit it into a pattern, we lose, because we insist on knowledge that we cannot really have. You know, let me say this to you. I studied this book for 30-some years, and there are a lot of questions I still have. A lot of things that are not resolved, I have not resolved in my own mind yet. As to the place of the sovereignty of God, for example, and the free will of man. I hold both of those things. I believe that we have a free will to accept Christ whenever we want to, but I believe that he has a sovereignty over the universe. Now, if you ask me, how do we get these two together, I'm not going to tell you, because I don't know. But other people know, and they tell you. But unfortunately, they all know something different, and they split the church. If Christ, if his Spirit had revealed to us these truths, the church wouldn't split over them. And one of the fellows left our outfit down there because he couldn't go along with me in my view of eternal security, as he calls it. And he announced to me, well, I've become a Reformed theologian now, and I wanted to say, what's that? You know, there's a Reformed theologian. I know what it is by definition. A Reformed theologian is someone who has modified the Calvin view. See, John Calvin believed that some were predestined to be saved and some were predestined to be lost. That it's all fixed. Now, the Reformed theologian couldn't stomach that, so he only takes one leg of it. He says, well, I believe God predestines those that are going to be saved, but he doesn't predestine the lost. Well, I don't know how you get around the fact that the one requires the other in a way. But so he announces to me, now I'm a Reformed theologian. Well, I know what the Reformed theologians are. I know what Calvin is. I know what Luther is and all the rest of them. But I'm not buying their system, see? So this fellow tells me that, and he's been studying for 4 or 5 years, and he knows the answers now. The thing that he was objecting, one thing he objected to. Now, he enjoyed the fellowship, enjoyed the people, enjoyed all these things. But one thing he objected to. I have made the statement, and you guys have probably heard me say this. Well, I believe that we're all very secure if we want to follow Christ, and that there's plenty of evidence that the Lord will hold us steady and so forth. But I cannot say absolutely that no one could ever walk away from Christ. I can't say that. I don't know enough to say that. If we can't be saved by our good works, we're not going to be lost because we don't have something good there, you see. The only way you can be saved is to take Christ into your spirit. The only way you could be lost would be if it were possible to walk away from Christ, to dismiss him. I don't know whether you can or not, but I cannot say absolutely, positively, that no one could ever walk away from Christ.
He won't walk away from you.
No, he doesn't walk away from us, but no, that's the whole point. He's not going to leave us, but a guy might leave him, say, maybe. I don't even say he will. I don't even know anybody personally that I can say for sure has walked away from Christ and been lost. I don't even know anybody. But I don't know enough to rule it out. If I were God, I could tell him, but I'm not God. I don't know what God's going to do. So here's a fellow that leaves the fellowship, not because he's not getting blessed, not because he doesn't like the fellowship, for one reason. I'm not strong enough on the eternal security thing. He has now become a Reformed theologian, and my theology doesn't fit with that thing.